The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Shartok. Joining us today for the first time is State Senator Julia Salazar, a Democrat from New York's 18th Senate District and chair of the Committee on Women's Health. Senator Salazar's district includes the Brooklyn neighborhoods of Bushwick, Cypress Hills, Greenpoint, and Williamsburg, as well as part of Bedford, Stuyvesant, Brownsville, and East New York. Upon her election in 2018, she became the youngest woman to be elected in the history of the New York State Senate. Senator Salazar previously worked as a community organizer in the neighborhoods she represents and across New York City. She began her advocacy during her time as a college student at Columbia University, where she advocated for the rights of fellow tenants and service industry workers. Until her election to the state Senate, Senator Salazar served as a community organizer for Jews for racial and economic justice, working within the city and statewide coalitions to advance criminal legal reform and police accountability legislation. Senator Salazar is also an active member of the National Association of Latino Elected Officials and the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, I just read your bio, and it says that you're the youngest ever in the state Senate. How young?
I just turned 28 years old. I'm the youngest woman to have served in the New York State Senate.
That's great. When did you decide you wanted to be a senator?
I had been inspired by other women's electoral campaigns in the past, including in my own district. A candidate named Debbie Medina ran in the election before the one that I ran in, and I was a volunteer in her campaign and very inspired by her. And even though her campaign was ultimately didn't end in victory, it motivated me to become more involved in other electoral work. She also had run openly as a Democratic Socialist, which I had been organizing with the Democratic Socialists of America locally, and early last year, so only about 9 months, 8 months before the primary election, I had a few friends approach me and encourage me to run. And after they really pushed me to do it, and I considered particularly the affordable housing crisis that our communities were facing, and the opportunity to potentially change it this year with the rent laws renewal, I finally committed to running early last year. And it really was a sprint because I publicly announced only about 5 months before our September primary last year.
Are your political science teachers at Columbia proud of you?
That's a good question. I didn't even study. I study history, although a lot of overlap with political science. I hope they're proud.
That's great. The term Democratic Socialist, of course, has some people worried because this is not traditional. How do you react to that?
Yeah, I think that is important for people to understand what we mean by democratic socialism in fighting for a society that's more equitable, in which people who currently are unable to move up socioeconomically have the opportunity to thrive.
And what you worry about is that people will think democratic socialist means communist.
Don't you? Yeah. And that's a reasonable concern that people would make that connection, even though it doesn't necessarily mean communism. I find that when I was campaigning and knocking on doors, a field was really valuable in our campaign. We knocked on over 100,000 doors over the course of the campaign in the district. And throughout that time, you know, not everyone is interested in talking about democratic socialism, certainly. And I'm certainly more interested in the policies and issues that are
rent
impacting.
Control.
Yes, rent, including rent control, absolutely. But it did present opportunities to talk to people about what it actually means to be a democratic socialist.
Now, as a Latina, what's the root there?
My father's from Colombia, and his entire family still lives there.
Wow. Mm-hmm. I've just recently taken a trip there. It was great, great fun. How unified is the Latino community in New York? I mean, because there are various branches, obviously. Is everybody together?
I would say it's very diverse. It's very eclectic. In fact, in my district, there is not, I wouldn't say there's a large Colombian community. It's primarily Dominican and Puerto Rican and spread out in different parts of the district. However, in the district, it's overwhelmingly Democrat, which is even more than other districts in New York State.
Governor Cuomo has been regarded by many people as a centrist who tacked left in recent years. Do you have issues with the governor?
I think that the governor and I have definitely different policy priorities, to say the least. But I think that there are some things that we also mutually agree on, perhaps more differences than not.
So how divided? Because we have been hearing that there are relationship problems between the governor and the state senate. Now, mm-hmm. the governor always had the Republican state senate where he wanted them. So now he's got the Democrats to deal with. I think he's been rougher on the Democrats than he has been on the Republicans. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering whether you can give us any insights.
Yeah, I think that it's challenging for the governor and for the new majority in the state Senate mm-hmm. to navigate this change in the political dynamic, having to work more closely together. And I say that, of course, as a freshman legislator and not having experienced the Republican-controlled Senate. I think that when it comes to the relationship between the state Senate and the governor, the biggest issue has been over the Amazon deal.
Sure.
At least it's been presented that way, even sure. though I would argue that the state Senate didn't actually play a really significant role in the ultimate outcome of Amazon withdrawing from the Long Island City deal. And that is a point where the governor and I definitely differed was our stance on that deal and I would say on economic development in general.
He was pretty angry.
Yeah, I think he was pretty upset.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about your number one topic, rent control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I grew up on 96th Street in New York City, and my parents paid $100 a month for a long time for an apartment. Of course, that was a long time ago.
Right.
That 100 is now certainly 1,000, and that's considered a deal.
Oh, yeah.
Hard for me to believe.
Right.
Nevertheless, the landlords put a lot of money into these political campaigns, don't they?
Yeah. It seems that the lobby, REBNY, and the Rent Stabilization Association have put a ton of money into trying to oppose certainly universal rent control, but any radical changes to rent regulation and any expansion of it.
We're talking with Julia Salazar. So, Senator Salazar, when you take their money, I don't mean you, I mean when a politician takes their money, do they have to pay off? I mean, it's a crime to say, if I pay you, will you do this? But there's a certain understanding that goes on.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it's why I've committed to never take any money from the real estate lobby and maintain that throughout my campaign, as well as any corporate donations. It's really important that we remain accountable to the grassroots and to the people we represent. I'm hopeful that some of my colleagues who may have taken real estate money will still make sure that during the rent laws fight that they're actually informed by their constituents and tenants more than anything, because the majority of New Yorkers are tenants and are currently disadvantaged in the fight to stay in their homes.
This has always been a sort of New York City problem. Mm-hmm. This program is heard in New York City, but it's heard all over the place. Is there a chance that this rent control thing is going to move upstate and to other places?
I think so. Tenants upstate and outside of the city in the suburbs, Long Island as well, are increasingly rent burdened. We're seeing it here in Albany as well. And more of these tenants are organized. They are part of a strong coalition statewide called the Upstate Downstate Housing Alliance, something that's called the Housing Justice for All Coalition. And they've been up in Albany every Tuesday throughout the last year, at least, advocating for the expansion of rent regulation because tenants who are outside the city currently have virtually no protections from eviction and displacement, and they're increasingly struggling. I've never seen the housing justice movement as unified as it is right now as far as solidarity between upstate and downstate tenants. And I think that that will make the difference in the rent laws fight is in persuading even legislators outside of the city that something needs to be done to protect tenants.
Well, of course, now you have the Democrats in control of the Senate, and that makes all the difference because it was the Republicans who used to say no to a lot of this. Do you ever worry that the politicians in the Assembly, who were always opposed to insidious rent controls, will, now that the Senate is Democratic, will turn on their heels and go the other way because they're taking the lobbying money?
I'm hopeful that both the Senate and the Assembly have a majority of legislators who know how important this issue is for tenants and will resist the potential temptation to cave to the real estate lobby's priorities and talking points. I think that especially with the new majority in the state Senate and a largely progressive majority at that, and new legislators who, including myself, who are not accountable to private interests like the real estate lobby, that we can help to drive the conversation and make sure that it is in favor of tenants.
So what does the internal organization of the Senate look like now? You have Mike Gianaris, who's number two. You have an outstanding leader. You just said something that really piqued my interest, which was that it's a progressive Senate now. Mm-hmm. Is it, or is some of the same old interests in the Democratic Party controlling things?
Yeah, I think that the Democratic Party is changing in a positive way, in a more progressive direction. And I think that Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins has played a really admirable leadership role in that she is part of leading the Democratic Senate to the Democratic majority to prioritize women's issues, to prioritize racial justice and economic justice. And likewise with the deputy leader, Senator Mike Gianaris, I think that even though they are, of course, more senior members, I think that they've been supportive of a new progressive majority continuing to lead us in the right direction policy-wise.
So we know that the Republicans were able to stay in control for a long time because of the gerrymander.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything to prevent, because you have to wait really till 2021 to reapportion, why couldn't it just be done now and then do it again in 2021?
I think that it's probably best to wait until after the census.
So the big thing now, and we're talking to Julia Salazar, the youngest senator elected in New York. So what do you have to avoid to make sure that you don't screw it up and have the Republicans come back into power, in which case you lose everything because of the gerrymandering?
Yeah. Thankfully, I feel that our majority is strong right now, that our conference is strong, but that is what we need to maintain. We need to maintain unity, making sure that even though we have a diverse conference with very different constituencies across the state, that ultimately we are that we reach consensus on votes, on issues, and that we present that to the public.
So do you fight? I mean, here's an issue. We know that many of the, and the governor's told me this, that many of the senators who got elected from Westchester and suburban areas, they are more conservative than the people who were often more conservative than the people who were representing districts like yours. And you realize, of course, that in order to maintain your majority, you got to keep those people happy, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that the new legislators, some of them have more what you might call a marginal district, where it's more split between conservative sentiments and more progressive sentiments. But the fact that they were elected, and I would say that those representatives are progressive Democrats, whether it's Senator Metzger, Senator May, senators in Long Island. I think that they have a challenge of having to represent a more politically diverse constituency, including a partly at least a conservative constituency, than myself representing a very progressive
district. But you have to watch out for them, don't you? In other words, you guys have an obligation in order to stay in power to make sure that they keep their constituents happy, too, so that you may have policy disagreements, but there's got to be some kind of leveling.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there is, I think, that is the biggest challenge, but a healthy challenge of debating any issue, certainly more, you know, controversial issues, is making sure that we're actually representing the entire state. And that includes more conservative areas and constituencies. And even as a Democratic Socialist, very progressive legislator, I recognize that need. And it's part of trying to govern democratically.
Have you decided who you're supporting in the presidential sweepstakes?
Actually, yes. I'm very excited to support Bernie Sanders. I did in 2016 as well, until and then Hillary Clinton in the general election. But
so why are his numbers falling so precipitously in all of the polls?
Are they falling
yes,
so
they
precipitously?
Yeah.
Interesting. I think it might be the initial impact of Senator Biden Joe Biden. Former Senator Joe Biden entering the race.
Okay, so let's go to a couple of other issues. One of them is measles, I take it you were inoculated at some point. You had your shots.
Yeah, I did. I received the MMR vaccines.
And now we find that there's a resistance to that among some people. I hear from almost every one of them. I have no sympathy, but it happens, and we're having this measles outbreak. What do you think ought to be done?
I think that community leaders and legislators, we really need to, first and foremost, be urging everyone in our communities to vaccinate their children. It's a very urgent public health issue. I'm wary of saying it's an emergency. It seems to have been mitigated or under control now, but even in part of my own district, there was a measles outbreak in the hundreds in Williamsburg, and thankfully community leaders responded saying it's really important to vaccinate. I think that as far as legislation, I'm supportive of Senator Hoylman's bill to repeal the religious exemption. I don't think that it should be presented as unique to a religious exemption, even though it technically is in New York State. But the idea is that unless there is a medical reason to not vaccinate, it really is a public health issue, and we have an obligation to protect other children who are in schools, even if it means that all of us have to work together and some of us need to, you know, put aside our personal beliefs about vaccines.
So let's talk a little bit about congestion pricing. You represent parts of Brooklyn. Some of those people have to drive into New York City. They're going to probably pay a toll on a bridge. They're going to probably pay a toll for even entering Manhattan. Do you think that's right?
I was supportive of congestion pricing. I'm wary of a consumer side tax or fee rather than, for example, I would have liked to see us pass the pied-à-terre tax. I would like to see taxes paid more equitably across income levels, but in absence of, you know, other sufficient sources of revenue, I was supportive of congestion pricing. In my own district, we found that with data from Transportation Alternatives and some of the other groups that had been working on congestion pricing for a long time, that less than 2% of the residents in my district would actually pay a congestion fee. A lot of people rely on public transit, or they don't commute in and out of the central business district. I know that there are other districts where more people will be paying the fee, and there have been efforts to try to mitigate that. But I think that ultimately it's the price that we pay to have a world-class public transit system.
Are you satisfied with the world-class public transportation system, including the L train from Brooklyn?
I've been disappointed, I think, at times with the lack of transparency about what is going to happen with the L train, initially a shutdown and now a slowdown, exactly how they're going to do the repairs in the tunnel. But overall, I can take a step back and say that the MTA is a good system that is accessible to a lot of people currently, but we really need to fight to make sure that that remains the case and also to expand access to people.
Do you think Governor Cuomo has been fair when it comes to the MTA? He stood in front of the new East Side subway and said, this is my doing, and then later on said he wasn't in control of it. I mean, it seemed like there was a little bit of, well, for want of a better word, hypocritical split there. I'm wondering what your take on that was.
Yeah, I think that at times the governor has been inconsistent about the state's role in managing the MTA. I would unambiguously say that ultimately the governor is responsible for the MTA. I think that in this budget process, his messaging changed in his stance on it, and I think that he's taken more responsibility for the management of the MTA the state legislature as well. We certainly have an obligation to step up and recognize that it's not the city's problem. It doesn't only impact the city by any means, and also it's our responsibility to fix it.
That's for sure. Let's talk ethics. What would you like to see done? You know, you have already said that you're not taking a certain amount of money from certain lobbyists. What do you think ought to happen?
I think that I want to see first more legislators committing to not take money from private interests, from corporate PACs, mm-hmm. or from the real estate industry. It's really had an outsized and, in my opinion, negative impact on politics and on the political climate across the state. I think that we should pass comprehensive campaign finance reform to disincentivize people taking money just from wealthy donors and being able to see more people-driven, democratic grassroots campaigns. And as far as other ethics issues, we really need to address the issue of sexual harassment in the workplace, including in the legislature.
Have you been harassed?
No, thankfully. I have been in previous jobs, but not in my time in the legislature, thankfully.
Yeah. You think things have... Because when, I had interns there and the rest of it, it was pretty bad for a while.
Yeah, yeah. And those problems, I don't think, were adequately resolved, particularly with certain former assembly members. Earlier in this session, we held the first sexual harassment public hearing on sexual harassment in the workplace that had been held since 1992 in the state Senate. In the state legislature. It was a joint legislative hearing. And from that hearing, we were able to look at some potential policy fixes. And we're hosting another hearing very soon at the end of the month on sexual harassment as well, and are generating legislation that's informed by the testimony in those hearings, hearing from people who worked in the legislature and have been impacted by it, as well as people who have faced harassment in other workplaces in New York. So I see that as a major issue. It isn't exclusive to the legislature, but we need to begin with the legislature.
So now you have this chairmanship of a committee and deals with?
With women's issues, yeah.
And you have a women's health issue that you're taking on. What's that?
So I really appreciate that. At the beginning of this session, the majority leader created this new committee, new standing committee on women's issues, which had never previously existed in the state legislature. I have been looking primarily at issues of women's health, although potentially other issues that disproportionately impact women.
For example?
Such as we passed legislation through the committee that I was lead sponsor of that passed early in the session on comprehensive contraception coverage. We passed legislation through the committee related to menstrual products.
What did you want to see there? You want to see them more available?
Yes, yeah. Uh-huh. More available. Also, more awareness about the potential impacts of using certain products that they previously haven't had to disclose, and the potential impacts on women's health. additional legislation with regard to sexual harassment, although it doesn't exclusively affect women. It does mostly affect women. And I think that we want to continue to focus mostly on maternal mortality and different health issues that can potentially contribute to maternal mortality, such as the prevalence of getting C-sections or emergency surgery, looking at the link between that and an alarming maternal mortality rate in New York State.
Are you, we've only got a couple of minutes. Are you happy with the way in which the hospitals are responding to what you're studying?
Yeah, it's been hard to gauge in a short period of time, but so far, the public particularly, I think, is welcoming a more robust public discourse and the legislature trying to take action to improve women's health overall. I think people recognize that when women's health is improved, our families are healthier and our society is healthier.
Say that again. Okay, we only have about a minute for it. But marijuana in New York State, are we going to see it?
I think so. I think even recently, the governor reiterated his own support for it. I'm supportive of Senator Krueger's bill, the MRTA, to finally legalize and strictly regulate adult use cannabis. I think it's time.
There are those people who think that it's not been a fair deal because the people who have basically been most screwed in society, you know, have not had, you know, rights in terms of distribution. Do you think that's true?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that the communities that have been hurt the most, including communities of color, communities that I represent, who have been harmed by criminalization, should be leading and at the forefront of the benefits of us legalizing
it. How?
By, first of all, I think that convictions related to, you know, low-level marijuana offenses should be vacated and expunged.
What about sales and distribution?
For previously, before legalizing?
Look, it's going to go to the big guys to get rid of this stuff.
So going forward.
So is there some way, is there some way to bring everybody in on it, on the benefits?
Yeah, I think we that needs to be the top concern when we talk about integration and what the market looks like, making sure that it's empowering the communities that have been disadvantaged the most by the criminalization of it.
Would you have the stuff sold, for example, in bodegas?
I think that if they have a license to, yeah, if we're able to regulate it, I don't see why not.
It's great to have you here. And by the way, I hope you'll come back. You're terrific. We're out of time. Our guest has been State Senator Julia Salazar, a Democrat from New York's 18th Senate District and chair of the Committee on Women's Health. Senator Salazar, you're terrific. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ellen. Appreciate it.